Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I'm talking with Anne Walther, author of Loss of Innocence, a novel of the French Revolution. Now, before we get started, let me tell you a little bit about Anne. Anne Newton Walther is a published author and lecturer who coined the phrase divorce hangover and brought it into the lexicon of divorce. Her groundbreaking book, also titled Divorce Hangover, deals successfully with the emotional after effects of divorce. It was published by Pocket Books in hardcover in 91 and in softcover in 1992, and it is considered one of the definitive texts on the subject and has received broad acceptance by professionals and individuals alike. Walther's frequent appearances on Oprah Winfrey, CNN's Sondra Live, Cable Network's Attitudes, NBC's Jenny Jones, and countless other local television and radio interview shows in the U.S. and Canada have further established her as a recognized authority on the subject. Walther has a background in history and psychology and heads a divorce and career counseling firm. She was raised in Virginia and now lives in San Francisco, where she and her husband raised their 5 children. I'm so happy to have Anne Walther on the phone today. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Anne.
Thank you, Juanita. It's lovely to be here.
Wonderful. So, Anne, when did your love of history begin, and why did you decide to shift your direction from writing about divorce and psychology themes into the historical fiction novels?
My love for history really started from my childhood. I was very fortunate because my father loved history and had a library that had a lot of history books as well as biographies. And so at a very surprisingly early age, I started reading them and developed a real background in history and discovered that when I got to school that, in fact, the classroom history was very boring and dull. And I was just so fortunate to have had those wonderful books in my own home where I could talk about them to my father. So history really came alive for me. And then it's a great question, how did I switch or shift from psychology and divorce to revolutions and history?
Right.
Well, in a funny way, if you look at it a certain way, which I'm sure is how my mind worked, they're all about revolution. A divorce is a revolution. It's a complete change in your life, turns your life upside down, and forces you to look at the world in a new way, just as a revolution does. And the reason I first wrote historical fiction was my love of the island of Bermuda. And I don't know how familiar people are with Bermuda, but it's right off, 500 miles off the coast of North Carolina. And it's a wonderful little island that is still very much the way it was when it was first founded in 1609. And I have been going there for years and years, and I finally decided that I wanted to give something back to Bermuda. So I decided to write a novel about Bermuda. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be sort of a Daphne du Maurier thing with fog and pirates and ships and romance and suspense. However, when I went to Bermuda to research it, now I've been to Bermuda many times, but it never gotten really below the surface. When I researched Bermuda, I discovered that Bermuda's history was very entwined with the American colonies and later the United States of America, and there were elements in the history that were far more fascinating than anything I could make up. And so that's what moved me to write the first historical fiction, A Time for Treason.
A Time of Treason, yes.
Yeah. And then at the end of A Time for Treason, I felt that the central character, Eugénie Devereaux, who is out of sight, she is a fabulous central character.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's the best since Scarlett O'Hara, quite frankly, even if I say so myself, she was not finished. So I felt, oop, I've got to carry on with Eugénie. So I just went to the next natural revolution, which was the French Revolution, and that's how Loss of Innocence came about.
Oh, great. Well, why don't you start, because I know A Time for Treason is actually somewhat of a sequel to Loss of Innocence.
Well, it's the other way around.
Okay.
A Time for Treason is the American Revolution, and then Loss of Innocence comes later as the, and is the French Revolution.
Comes after, right. So why don't you give us the backstory, what goes on in A Time for Treason to get readers up to speed on what Loss of Innocence is about?
Okay, thank you. A Time for Treason deals with this wonderful nugget of actual history that I came across in the research. And the nugget was that a group of Bermudians conspired with a group of American patriots, this was right at the brink of the American Revolution, to hand over the Bermudian, entire Bermudian gunpowder to the American patriots. And, of course, the gunpowder on Bermuda did not belong to these Bermudians. It was government. It belonged to Britain. Mm-hmm. And so by offering this up and creating a scenario so that the Americans could get their hands on it, each and every one of those Bermudians were committing treason. And yet they went ahead and did it anyway. And the thing that is so exciting about this, and very few people know about this.
I've never heard of it, yeah.
No, and you never read it in American history books. All the Bermudians know it. It's called the Gunpowder Plot.
Mm.
However, what particularly makes it exciting is that this gunpowder was essential to the carrying out of the revolution. George Washington and his troops had used up all of their ammunition. They were out of gunpowder, virtually out of it. And by getting this new supply of gunpowder, they could carry on the war for independence. And the first battle, when George Washington crossed the Delaware, the very first battle, the Battle of Trenton, they used this Bermudian gunpowder. That's how incredible this story is.
That is just fascinating. And you discovered that in history books in Bermuda?
Well, I discovered it. It was in the history books in Bermuda, but I discovered it from an even better source. There are families now living in Bermuda who are descendants of the original families that arrived there at the beginning of the 1600s.
Wow.
Every family that came in those early ships to Bermuda in the early 1600s have a family that still lives there today.
Wow.
And these people kept their family letters. They kept primary sources. I mean, it was like a treasure. Anybody who loves history, you know that the best source is anything that's original, not something that's been written by historians long after the fact. Sometimes that's all we have to work with. But when you've got primary sources, I mean, it's unbelievable. That's why, and everyone who reads A Time for Treason says it rings so true, it rings so real, and it's because I had conversations in letters between fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, these elements that you simply cannot get in a history book.
That's
and
amazing.
It's a stunning, stunning opportunity for a writer.
And for yourself as well, being interested in human nature, human behavior, people in general,
yes.
That must have been fascinating for
you. It was unbelievable.
Mm.
That's when I knew I was on the right track, I was given the gift of conversation with these descendants.
Mm.
And I had only two names when I first started my research, and I had interviews with these two people, and then they recommended other people who were descendants, and it just spread out like that, like a huge web network of people. And it was just extraordinary. I mean, it was just mind-blowing.
Great.
And that was the real stuff. That was the real history, and that's why Time for Treason really sings. You get the culture of Bermuda. You can see the place. You can feel it. You can hear it. You can smell it, all those good things.
Mm-hmm.
However, then I wove my fictitious elements in there to just add another layer of richness, and that's where this wonderful Eugénie Devereaux comes in.
Please tell us about her.
Eugénie Devereaux was a young woman And when she was 15, her parents' merchant ship was sunk by a British ship. Her family was French. Her father was a count, and when both of her parents were killed, she inherited the title, so she was a French countess.
Mm.
And she was sent by her constituency, a group of the nobility in France, over to the colonies to find out what exactly were those patriots up to. Were they just, you know, upset and having a temper tantrum about these horrible taxes that the British government was levying on them, or were they in fact going to fight and separate themselves from Britain? And what she discovered was, yes, indeed, they were going to fight. They were going to go for their independence to separate the American colonies, American-British colonies, from the mother country, which was England. And this was what her constituency wanted to know, because if these patriots were going to fight for their independence, then the French wanted to help the patriots, because the French, as you know, would do anything to tweak the British nose, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
They were always back and forth at each other. And so this gave the French a great opportunity to really take advantage of this situation and aid, and in so doing, aid the American revolutionaries and help our revolution succeed. So that's how she found herself over there in the colony. She was actually in the colony of Virginia.
Okay.
And there are all sorts of things that occur in Virginia, and she finally has to flee for her life, and that's how she ends up on the island of Bermuda. And instead of being safe, she discovers that she has found herself in the center of this political conspiracy, which is very dangerous, between the Bermudians and the Americans. And so the story goes on from there.
Oh, great.
So that's a time for treason. And that young woman, Eugénie Devereux, then returns to her home in France, where she is this extraordinary female, powerful, influential figure, owns a huge land in the Valley of Bordeaux, and she raises vines and makes wine, among other things. But she then wants to be a part of the revolution that begins to build in France. So she was a revolutionary herself in the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a loss of innocence. That's how she gets going into the French Revolution in Loss of Innocence.
In your second book. So what happens in Loss of Innocence? She's involved in the revolution, but can you give us more synopsis on the story?
Sure. Again, what matters to me, in because I do love history, and it's exciting to me to excite other people about history. So I always have some nugget that's actual, that actually occurs, and then I spin my yarn around that. And the nugget in Loss of Innocence that actually did happen was, again, a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And this time it was between a group of Americans and a group of the French nobility who, even though they were revolutionaries, were very concerned about what would happen to France if Marie Antoinette were executed. And so these two groups come together to plot to rescue Marie Antoinette and take her back across the Atlantic to the state of Pennsylvania, where they were going to build a town for Marie Antoinette. This is true.
That's amazing.
And this is, again, something that people don't know about. And this is what makes history so fascinating. It's so much more than the battles and the generals and the treaties and the dates. It's the story of a people and
mm-hmm.
what people do in their daily lives that change the outcome of big, great events. And this is, to me, what makes history exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing the culture of a place, feeling as though you were walking in Paris with those revolutionaries, or you were riding across the countryside in Bordeaux. I really think that in these books, I bring history alive so that you are there. It's not something that's at a distance.
Yes,
you feel where you are.
Absolutely. You definitely bring that to your books. Now, for listeners that need a refresher on the French Revolution, when it was, why there was a revolution, you know, what caused it, as well as the mood of the people at the time, would you just talk a little bit towards that?
Sure. I think first it's interesting to kind of compare the American Revolution and the French Revolution, because even though they were both revolutions and they changed the status quo forever, that's all they had in common. In every other respect, they were so very different. The American Revolution was carried out by a population of educated, self-governing people. These American colonists had for years been on their own, separated from the mother country. They had to run their town meetings. They had to run their little towns, their communities, etc. They were used to power. They were used to political power. On top of that, they were educated. Both young women and young men in the early colonies were educated. It wasn't just the young men who were educated. The young girls were as well. So this was an educated population. Now let's look at the French population that went into the revolution. With the exception of the ministers who headed up the French government, the rest of the population had no conceivable understanding of power or self-governing or anything like that. On top of that, for the most part, and Eugenie is an exception to this, for the most part, the nobility, men were educated to a degree, but women really were not. Mm-hmm. And Marie Antoinette is a perfect example of someone who knew how to do needlework, knew how to sing a pretty song, could play instruments, but she could barely read and write. And this creates an entirely different group of people, so that when the revolution got going in France, these were not people used to power and used to running their own lives and educated. These were people who suddenly saw an opportunity to grab power and really didn't know what to do with it. And that's why all these factions in the revolution erupted and they fought each other. They did not have their central goal like the American Revolution did. And the French Revolution just went to hell in a handbasket. They started with these wonderful high ideals, which I'd like to point out, my wonderful Eugenie continued to support, as did Lafayette and some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority, once they started on the high road and deteriorated into a bloodbath, a violent, chaotic society where there was no law. I mean, they kept preaching liberty, equality, and fraternity, but what they built, what they created was a police state. It was just a disaster.
Isn't that interesting?
No.
What years are we talking about for that revolution?
Well, it began in the history books, and I think it's a good place to start, the storming of the Bastille on July 14th of 1789 sort of marked what was considered the beginning of the revolution. That's when the military power in Paris changed from being under the king's thumb to being outside of the king's control and more in the hands of the people. And another interesting thing to do with the storming of the Bastille, when the mob attacked the Bastille, they didn't tear it down. They broke into it. They rescued. Everyone thought there were tons of prisoners in the Bastille. No, there weren't. There were only seven altogether, seven prisoners. And they were political prisoners. But they were set free, and then the mob marched through the city of Paris celebrating this accomplishment. The next day, Lafayette, who was a revolutionary, said, "We must tear down the Bastille. It's a symbol of the old regime. It has only negative connotation, and we rip that down, and it will symbolically change the political power and military power in the city of Paris." So he he was head of the National Guard. He was the commander of the National Guard. And so he's the one that said, commanded that the Bastille be taken down stone by stone. And they did. They ripped that thing down to the ground so that there was nothing left of it. It was all carted away. And this is another interesting little aside. Even back then, there were people that would exploit, take advantage of a situation. And there were guys that went in there and picked up the rubble from the Bastille, the stones that had built the Bastille, and sold them as souvenirs.
Oh, is that right?
Isn't that something? So today, there could be people throughout France who actually have some piece of the Bastille. But I don't know.
That's
but
incredible.
They were sold as souvenirs.
Wow.
And the Loss of Innocence, the novel about the French Revolution, starts with the storming of the Bastille, July 1789, and then ends with the execution of Marie Antoinette, and that's 1793. So the book covers a four-year period. But the French Revolution and its disaster went on several years after that, until Napoleon grabbed hold of the reins and pulled the thing back together. But the period of the book is from 1789 to 1793.
I see. Wow, that's just fascinating. So why don't you tell us a little more about Eugenie Devereaux? Do you think she was realistic for her time? And what does she represent in the wider context of these two stories?
Well, there were very strong individuals, human beings, back in that those times. When you think of the Abigail Adams, and you think of George Washington and Jefferson, and there were strong women and strong men. Clearly, we hear much more about the strong men, and that was true also in France. So I decided that even though we don't have a lot of information about individual women who were outstanding in their own right, that I would create one, because I'm sure they existed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was turned into Eugenie Devereaux. She was above average in height. She was, of course, magnificent looking, of course,
with
chestnut, long, beautiful chestnut hair and silver eyes. And she not only was beautiful, but she was exceptionally intelligent. Had been well educated by her parents, because they knew that as their only child, that she would have to be able to take over the running of their estates once they died. So she knew how to run something, unlike the majority of the female nobility back then. She also was an outstanding equestrian, and in both books there's a wonderful element with a horse that she owned called the Roan. And the Roan is in A Time for Treason, and then that same horse is in Loss of Innocence. And it's symbolic of a certain spirit. But she also, among other things that she did, she was very unconventional in many ways. She could certainly play the lady and look the part of a lady, a noble a woman. But she also was, when she was on her estate and training and working with her horses, she often would wear what men wore back then, which were breeches and a shirt and a jacket. So she was kind of, you could say, a cross-dresser. And whatever worked, she was very practical and pragmatic, was what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't really work a horse very hard if you're riding side saddle in these voluptuous skirts and one thing and another. And
right.
So that was just a little bit of how she broke the mold for back then. Was she realistic? Yes. I think there were, I'm sure, women who were similar to her character and personality back then, even though you don't run into them in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also what makes the book interesting.
Absolutely.
You know, if you always read the same old, and everybody's cut out of the same cookie cutter. I mean, how much fun is that?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So, of course, Eugenie has to be her own person.
Of course, of course. How was it for you to almost give birth to her as a character?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It's been my experience writing fiction that I think I come up with my ideas and then I sit down and start to write. I think the ideas are sent to me. They're plopped in front of my eyes and then I have no choice but to pick up my pen because I write out longhand to begin with.
Wow.
And it just starts, you know, just pouring out of the end of my pen. And so, yes, I like to think I created Eugenie, but from the first page of A Time for Treason and right through to the last page of Loss of Innocence, she was running the show. I mean, she knew exactly where she had wanted to go, what she had to do. I didn't conjure up all these things to begin with in a nice, tidy outline. It just kind of just flowed out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really seen, I've heard some other writers say this, that characters take on a life of their own. In fact, there's a character in Loss of Innocence who was also in A Time for Treason. Her name is Amelia Stanton. And I had planned at the beginning of Loss of Innocence to kill her off.
Mm.
She was an obnoxious personality,
mm-hmm.
I mean, delightfully obnoxious, and it was going to be so much fun to torture her and kill her. Well, she wouldn't be killed. I mean, she kept escaping.
Oh, no.
And it was amazing. You just, I won't say whether she ultimately died or didn't. I don't want to give everything away here, but she just kept getting away from me. I mean, she clearly had her own life to live, and then as you read the book, you'll see what ultimately happens to her.
That's great.
But many of these characters, all of them, speak for themselves. The words come out. Another thing that I didn't run into was writer's block.
Mm.
And I don't know how common or uncommon that is, but I just seem to write along.
Mm-hmm.
It was as though, well, here we go. And off we went. And the other thing, as I said, I don't and didn't use an outline for these books. I do for nonfiction. My nonfiction books, I did have an outline.
Sure.
But fiction has its own life, and I think it never occurred to me to try to outline it because I didn't know, with the exception of each actual historic event
right.
that triggered each book, I didn't know what the other elements were, the other events and things that were going to occur. Now, in Loss of Innocence, I do track the events that occur in the revolution that kind of spin this thing out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, I do follow the historical progress of the revolution and the different events that kept it rolling down this disastrous path it was on.
Yes, I think that's important for readers to know too, because you're not just building a story
right.
with the revolution. This story is actually about the revolution.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have my fictitious people dance in and out, adding, you know, some richness, some depth, and acting as if there is a gap between in the days or months between these events, these revolutionary events, then the fictitious people fill in the gaps
mm-hmm.
and keep it rolling.
Did you find it challenging at all to blend real life characters and real historical events in with your fictional characters?
No, because I see them all as human beings,
mm.
and maybe this is where the psychology and my interest in human behavior and all of that comes in,
mm-hmm.
They became equal to me.
Mm-hmm.
The real people, I really stuck to who they were, and I was true to their personalities, and the words that I put in their mouths would have been things they would have said, but they were also on a par with, because the other people became, the fictitious ones became members of that time, as true as the actual historic figures.
Mm-hmm.
And one wonderful blending is the romance between Eugénie Devereaux and Bridger Goodrich, because Eugénie is completely out of my imagination, or wherever your imagination comes from, that's
sure.
where she came from. Bridger Goodrich was a real historic figure of that time.
Well, I was going to ask you if he was real.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Very definitely real. And he was a rogue. He was a shipper. He traded all over the world. He was really a striking figure of that time. Not a particularly well-known one, but he was a Virginian originally, one of five brothers, and his family owned about four or five plantations on the James River. This is all true.
Mm.
And they had a very successful shipping business, so they traded all over the world. And at one point, and this is history as well, they took, overtook a Spanish ship and brought it. You could do that back then. You could, if you were able to, you could have a letter of, it was a special letter from your government that said that you could attack other nations' ships on your own.
Hmm.
I mean, and they could attack you. It worked both ways.
Wow.
But anyway, it was a legal thing to do, and they were called, these people were called privateers, not pirates, but privateers. And his ships, Bridger's and his family's ships, were very good at attacking Spanish ships and French ships, et cetera, et cetera. And then they would take their cargo, and that was their contraband. They got to keep the cargo and the ship.
Okay, wow.
So one of these ships that the Goodrich family attacked successfully was carrying a load of arms and ammunition. I mean, this is like gold back then.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought the ship into the colony of Virginia and stuck it all this wonderful cargo in one of their warehouses. Then, this is, I'm telling the real historical thing here, then some other group of Virginians somehow got wind of this great cargo that the Goodriches had captured, and they snuck into the warehouse and stole it all. Well, the Goodriches did not appreciate this, and so the Goodriches didn't go after those people directly. What they started doing was acting as spies for the British against the American colonies, and would start sneaking around and getting information about the American patriots. And so when the patriots learned about this, then they drove the Goodrich family out of Virginia, lock, stock, and barrel. They confiscated all their plantations. The only thing the Goodriches had left were their ships, and which was quite a fleet.
Mm-hmm.
So some of this family went up to the northern colonies and plagued the colonies around New York and Connecticut and those areas. And Bridger and one of his brothers stayed down in the Virginia area and continued to act on behalf of the British. So he was, in fact, it's very complicated. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
You can tell that none of these people seem to have a tremendous integrity by our modern-day definition.
It sounds like a dangerous time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so that made it really fun to have this swashbuckling Bridger Goodrich falling in love with my glorious Eugénie Devereaux.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have this glorious romance in A Time for Treason, and it continues in Loss of Innocence.
Loss of Innocence. Oh, that's fantastic. So you were saying that Loss of Innocence encompasses the death of Marie Antoinette. I'd
mm-hmm.
like you to talk more about your thoughts about her place in history and how you were able to gain the insight that you do into her character.
Well, she really, I think more and more in the last several years, I think it's been a remarkable the number of books and films and things that have come out about Marie Antoinette that have given her a much more honest description than what she was known as back during the time that she was alive. Mm. She originally, when she came over to France to marry the soon-to-be king, Louis the 16th, she was very young. She was 15. She was unprepared for the French court, the French style, the French etiquette. Her royal family was the Austrian royal family, and it was much less showy and decadent, quite frankly, than the French court. And she was very uncomfortable with how stiff and how severe the French court was in terms of how you had to behave and who you did, how you did what to whom, and this extraordinary type of dress, elaborate dress, as well as these huge head things that they would put on themselves. They didn't just powder their hair. They literally stuffed pads underneath their hair to get great height. Then they would put extensions on, not unlike today.
Mm-hmm.
And they trail around, and all they were concerned about was their next party or what they were going to eat that night. I'm talking about the nobility here.
Mm-hmm.
And she was used to a lot more freedom. She was used to being far more natural in her dress and in her manner. And so it was really, it was like she ran up against a brick wall in the French court. And initially, they thought she was charming and delightful until they realized that they couldn't bend her around to their will. In spite of being very naive and in many ways very unprepared, she was extraordinarily stubborn and willful. You weren't going to just boss her around. She pretty much did what she chose to do, and this offended all the in-circle, in-crowd types that had been running the court for so long. And so, bit by bit, rumors started about her, and then they became fact, whether they were or not. And she developed a very bad reputation, and she did nothing to disabuse people of it. It was beneath her to answer these rumors and this gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just kept growing and growing until she became the true monster in everybody's eyes. Not just the court, but the people at large in France began to see her as this horrible, decadent, grotesque creature, which she wasn't really at all.
Hmm. Isn't that something?
Yeah. And so it's nice, in a wonderful way, it's nice that finally, after all these centuries of misinformation, that now, today, there is a much clearer, more accurate picture of Marie Antoinette.
Yes.
And she was no saint, but she also was not the monster that they depicted her to be.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating.
It was grotesque when they were, when she was on trial for her life, they accused her of the most horrific, monstrous acts, one of which was having incest with her son.
Wow.
Which was absolutely not true.
Wow.
Absolutely. But it didn't matter what they threw at her.
Yeah.
It all stuck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was no way she could prove otherwise.
Right. They had their agenda.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Now, I'd like to hear your thoughts about France during the French Revolution and what was happening there, and any comparisons you have to bring this into, you know, present day now, possibly to Iraq.
Well, it was interesting to me. Thank you for that question.
Sure.
It was interesting to me that when I began to write this novel, it was just before, it was a couple of months before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a chapter in Loss of Innocence when Eugénie Devereaux's chateau is attacked by terrorists from the outside.
Mm.
And I wrote that 2 weeks before 9/11.
Wow.
And it was stunning to me when 9/11 happened. It was as though I had anticipated this horrible action against the United States through this chapter that I just written.
Mm-hmm.
And then after it's attacked, after the chateau is attacked, Eugenie meets with her, the main people at the chateau, and says, we must be more vigilant. We must be alert. We there is danger out there, and we have got to be really be constant in our vigilance. And two of her main people at the chateau say to her that she must close the granary and close the kitchen, which had always been open forever. Her family believed in helping the people in the countryside, and so anyone could come to her kitchen for food, and they could go to her granary for either to grind their grain or to get grain and have it turned into meal so that they could make bread. And this was part of her family's tradition. And she said, I will not be dictated to by fear.
Mm.
And the amazing thing was that that was virtually what Giuliani and Bush said after 9/11.
Mm.
We will not be we will find these people, we will run them to earth, but we will not be dictated to by fear. And so it was just, I mean, it gave me goosebumps when I realized I had just written this very stuff. And then what made it more interesting is as the book progressed and the revolution, events of the revolution occurred and France began to fall apart, it was as though the emphasis shifted and the France of the French Revolution became a parallel to what happened and is happening in Iraq today.
Mm.
They even used the same words. Back then, there was a European coalition, there's one word, that united against France and invaded France, as we have, with our coalition, have invaded Iraq. Then within France, there was a civil war going on between different political factions and insurrectionists, et cetera, all the same words that are now being applied to Iraq.
Wow, the parallels are definitely there.
Stunning.
Mm-hmm.
And what pulled France back together was Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's going to pull Iraq back together or if it will be pulled back together.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't. I do not believe history is the best teacher there is. According to history, what's going on in Iraq today, what we're doing in Iraq today, will not cement Iraq back together.
Right, right. So what are your thoughts on terrorism as a two-edged sword?
Well, the thing, the French Revolution is such a perfect example of this. There were terrorists that were in all classes of society in France. You had, once the law of the land was torn apart, it didn't completely break down right away, but it was being taken apart by the storming of the Bastille and the change of the king not being the power, but the people taking over the power, then this tears the social fabric and it almost demands anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
As people can't rely on the old support systems and the laws, etc., that had always kept everybody more or less in place, the bad guys then suddenly had a free hand in doing whatever came into their heads. And in some cases it was a group of marauders in the countryside attacking Eugenie's chateau. That had nothing to do with the revolution. That wasn't helping the revolution. Those were just bad guys wanting to, you know, attack the haves and get some of their stuff. And then you had the terrorism that was going on within the body of the revolution, one group attacking another group, guillotining their enemies, and then the next guy would get in charge and guillotine his enemies, and it just went on from there. There was, and so you live by the sword, you die by the sword.
Mm.
So in a way, terrorism, depending on who's in charge, they don't call it terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
The guys who are supposedly on the outside, they are the terrorists. But the guys who are doing the very same thing, but they have the reins of power in their hand, they're not called terrorists.
Right.
But they are.
Sure. Absolutely. Fascinating.
Mm.
It's just been a great, great opportunity to talk with you, Anne. You are so full of information. This has been wonderful. Do you have plans for a third novel featuring Eugenie Devereaux?
Well, Eugenie will have to tap me on the shoulder.
Oh.
And believe me, she does not sit quietly very long.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm preparing myself for the next tap on the shoulder.
That's
I'm
great.
Sure she has a lot more to do.
That's great. Yes, I'm sure she does too. She's a very strong, strong woman and a strong character. So I think there will be a book three.
I'm sorry.
Is your website, Anne?
My website is Anne Walther, and that's spelled AnneWalther. That's one word. .com.
Great.
And I would love to have visitors to the website. There's a Marie Antoinette blog on the website.
I saw that. That is great.
Well, Juanita, then you've got to blog in.
I will.
And chat with Marie. She needs someone to talk to.
Oh.
She gets so bored at that court. And then in prison.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And listeners can purchase your books through your website as well?
Well, they can certainly purchase it through my website, also at Amazon.com.
Okay.
And any of their local bookstores.
Great. It can be ordered, or they may even be able to
mm-hmm.
find it in the stores.
Mm-hmm.
Well, great. That's wonderful, Anne. Now, our time is kind of coming to an end here. Boy, it's just been flying by so quickly. Is there any final thoughts you want to share with us today?
Well, I guess what I would love to get across is that history is a story, and it's all about stories, and it's so fascinating. And I think once, and that's one of the impetuses of my writing these books, to bring people to history, to indicate just how exciting it can be, and to learn about people through historical fiction or history, just straight, well, be sure you got a good history book.
Sure.
You can travel back in time and place. You can go anywhere you want to go, and you don't have to spend a dime except whatever it takes to buy the book. But you have the whole world from any vantage point you want to the future. You can go anywhere, and that's what history gives us. And I hope in a way that these two books just trigger people's excitement about time travel. This is a form of time travel.
Mm.
And visiting these fascinating people and walking on their streets and riding across their meadows and climbing their mountains and living dangerously. We think we're living in a dangerous time. Nothing compared to some of these other, unbelievable, the danger that existed both during our American Revolution and during the French Revolution, not to mention other times in history. But these two, you were not safe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were worried about your safety, you might as well just, you know, dig a big hole and jump in it.
Because, oh, God.
You know, and that's what people think today, that they are somehow, they can be safe.
Yes.
We can be safe today, far more so than those two periods of history, the individuals in those times.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful final thoughts, Anne. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, Juanita, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.
It was. I hope to have a chance to talk with you again. And best to you. Much success for Loss of Innocence. And we just thank you once again for this great interview.
Thank you.
All right.
It was my pleasure.
Great, Anne. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed this wonderful interview with Anne Walther. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Time has gone by so quickly. And the book, once again, Loss of Innocence, a novel of the French Revolution. It's available in stores now, as well as through Anne's website and online booksellers. To read a recent book review of Loss of Innocence that actually has made it to the USA Today and Reuters website, you can go to readerviews.com. Thanks again for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.